Well, I found that sermonette very interesting. I'm not sure if Mr. Sanders heard my last sermon 2 weeks ago. but it ties in nicely with that sermon and also with what I'm going to give today. But we obviously didn't conspire on this at all. But as you might recall from last, 2 weeks ago, we were looking at the Old Testament and looking at the issue of, do we have a complete and true Old Testament? And so we went through the entire sermon talking about that issue. And I mentioned at the beginning of that sermon that Mr. Franks had given some written some articles in The Plain Truth. They're in Life, Hope, and Truth now. There was also a booklet based on those articles where he listed five proofs of the Bible, and I put proofs in quotation marks because you can't absolutely prove most things. It's more the preponderance of evidence, as I talked about last time, that leads us to the conclusions of what's true and what's not. And so he listed these five and wrote an article in each one. One that I liked was a quote from his article on biblical archaeology. And this is from, Mr. Franks quoted from Nelson Gluck, who is one of the most well-known of the Jewish archaeologists of the 20th century. And the quote was, "It may be stated categorically that no archaeological discovery has ever been controverted a biblical reference. Scores of archaeological findings have been made which confirm in clear outline or in exact detail historical statements of the Bible. And by the same token, proper evaluation of biblical descriptions has often led to amazing discoveries." And so, you know, biblical archaeology, he talked about, the Dead Sea Scrolls, he talked about, evidence from secular history is another one that he discussed, fulfilled prophecy, and then consistency of the Bible. And as I mentioned last time, my goal is not to rehash what he wrote, but to go a little bit further and a little more in depth on some of these things. And last time I added two more. One was verification by Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ verified the Old Testament on many occasions by quoting to it, specifically quotes, but also in referring to many incidents that occurred or recorded in the Old Testament. And then I added a seventh to the list here, the record of consistency by the Levitical priesthood in copying the Old Testament and very accurately copying the Old Testament. As a matter of fact, we'll get more evidence on that today. Now, my original intention was to talk about the New Testament today. But after thinking about it this past week, I decided that I was going to stay with the Old Testament a little bit longer because I think I told you last time I spoke that I was planning on giving a sermon on the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so I decided I think it would be more appropriate maybe to give that sermon today since that does tie in more with the Old Testament and not the New Testament. And so what we're going to do is go much more in depth into the Dead Sea Scrolls than what Mr. Franks was able to do in his short article that he wrote. So we'll be looking at that, and we need a little bit of background here ahead of time, and that is what was happening to the Jews in what's generally referred to as the diaspora, the dispersion of the Jews throughout Middle East, Europe, Asia Minor, North Africa. It began with the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC when the Jews were taken to Babylon. But it was the majority that were relocated in Babylon and the vicinity, but not all of them. As a matter of fact, some relocated to Egypt against Jeremiah's message from God. As you might recall, in Jeremiah 42:19, the Lord has said concerning you, O remnant of Judah, do not go to Egypt. Know certainly that I have admonished you this day. And then if you look at the whole context of that section of Jeremiah, you can see that God makes some pretty strong warnings about what was going to happen to them if they did that. And basically he was saying, I'm cutting you loose, you will not have my protection, and it's not going to be good for you if you go there. But they did anyway. They pretty much flaunted in the face of Jeremiah and said, we're going, and they did. So, and then in this period that Mr. Sanders mentioned, from 300 to 100 BC, there were a number of Jewish migrations. It was during this period that the Seleucid Empire, which was controlling Israel after Alexander the Great's death, began to break up, and it was a time of a lot of things going on. And so Jews were beginning to voluntarily move to other locations. And some moved to Egypt. Matter of fact, quite a few moved to Egypt, and particularly in the area of Alexandria. And so that became a major enclave of Jews as they moved during this period. And some moved up to Asia Minor. Matter of fact, if you look at the my map here, and I'm going to have to apologize to the people outside, because I'm going to be showing a lot of visual aids, a lot of slides and pictures and other things that it might be a little difficult to follow me if you're not watching the screen. So I don't know, it might be helpful if you, those outside, dial in the webcast and put it on mute so that you can see the slides that are taking place. But any case, This is showing the dispersion, the initial dispersion. This is 587, which says that some people will have give a different date. We say it's 586, and I think that's probably more accurate than 587. But in this period is when collapse of Jerusalem and the exile. But some were taken on up into other parts of the Persian area, and then some, as I said, went down to into Egypt during that period and later on. But but some came back. But then in the 300s to 100s BC, you find the Jews beginning to migrating on up into Asia Minor, more going into Egypt, and more going into North Africa. As a matter of fact, let's bring up the complete map. It shows that during this 300 to, you probably can't, can you see that? Yeah, those years are pretty small there. You may not be able to see them, but like in the 300s to 100, Jews migrated all the way across North Africa during that period of time. But and the same thing up in here. But most of these migrations up into Europe, up into Russia, down into Spain, most of these occurred during the Middle Ages. During medieval times. And then these brown arrows, or kind of orangish brown, show when they were expelled from various countries. And so many of the places they moved to at some point or another, and again, mostly during the Middle Ages, they were expelled and kicked out from time to time. So there was a lot of moving and on of the Jewish people. Now, I want to focus on those that moved to Egypt. Now, Ptolemy II was a ruler of Egypt during this initial period of, I'll show you some dates here in just a moment. But he was the son of Soter. And Soter was the Greek general under Alexander, one of the four, who fought over Alexander's kingdom after he died, and Soter ended up with Egypt, basically, and some of the surrounding areas. And it took about 20 years for these generals to sort all that out. There were various wars and fighting between them before they finally sorted it out. There's a picture of a Soter and his wife on a coin of the time. And he looks, you know, just looking at that, coin, he looks pretty formidable. Well, Ptolemy II was his son. And so he set up the kingdom. Ptolemy II followed him. And he ruled in Egypt and part of the Levant from about 283 to 246. And so this was a period when a number of Jews were migrating down into Egypt, particularly the Alexandria area. And they also have found some coins of the time with Ptolemy II's photo, picture on it. And I found it interesting to look at these two. I think it shows up pretty well. Now, Soter, he looks like a general. He looks tough. He looks kind of lean and mean. But now, Ptolemy, he looks a little like he's been overindulging a little bit, living the good life. He does, you know, little puffy cheeks and stuff. So he looks quite different from Soter. But, and that may have been the case because it was during this time that the material and the literary splendor of Egypt reached a very high point. And as a matter of fact, the reason I'm bringing this up is about midway through the 3rd century B.C., he brought in 70 Jewish scholars to Alexandria to translate the Torah into Greek. And so, now, the Jewish legend says it was 72, and so there's some discussion about that, but Mr. Sandilands mentioned this. The Septuagint was a product that came out of that. Now, from the mid-3rd century B.C. to the early 1st century A.D., other books were translated by unknown authors. And so gradually the entire Old Testament was translated in Egypt during that time. And as we talked about last time, those people were not the ones that God authorized to do so. The Levites in Jerusalem, as we went through in some detail in my last sermon, were the ones that were responsible for pulling in the copying and for the canonization of the Old Testament. Now, so the early Alexandrian Old Testament manuscripts, talked about that a little bit last time. I want to get into some more detail on some of these. The Septuagint, the Torah was translated by the Greek, as I said, by the 70 scholars. It was later followed by the rest of the Old and New Testament, but the authors, in most cases, are not clear. There were some translations of some of the early work that does have authors identified with it, but the original works is very unclear. One of the ones that is perhaps one of the two most well-known that came out of the Alexandrian era was Codex Vaticanus. That was in 300 to 305. A.D. It contains nearly a complete copy of the Septuagint in Greek. and then the Codex Sinaiticus, 330 to 360, somewhere in that range. And then again, this is a complete copy of the Old and New Testament in Greek. It was found in the Sinai Peninsula in a monastery there. It's generally similar to Vaticanus, but has a large number of corrections, and there's some differences, some significant differences between the two. Now, a third Bible that came out of that era was the Latin Vulgate. It was translated into Latin in 382 to 405 during that period. And Jerome was, the Pope gave him the responsibility of doing that translation into Latin, and this formed the basis of the Catholic Bible, as Mr. Sanders was talking about, various translations of that Bible down through the ages. So then there was another one called Codex Alexandrinus. It was a 5th century translation. Now, I bring up these because of their age. These are very old, but they were found very late. They were found in the 19th century, basically, is when most of these manuscripts were found. So they were discovered very late, but they're very old. Now, Alexandrinus had many differences with the other Egyptian manuscripts. So one thing that seemed to characterize these Egyptian manuscripts was they didn't agree that well. There were a lot of differences between these different manuscripts. And, of course, the main issue was the New Testament during that period of time that these were discovered. Now, the Old Testament books from these Egyptian manuscripts, there were a number of those, and Mr. Sanders was talking about in some detail, that were included, that were in some of these manuscripts, some additional psalms, so forth, some additional chapters of Daniel, and then various books that was mentioned by Mr. Sanderlands. I don't need to get into that. But I give you this history because a lot of these books go back to that era, particularly the Old Testament parts, go back to that era of around 300 B.C. to the time of Christ. And this happens to coincide with the Dead Sea Scrolls. So what about the Dead Sea Scrolls? What do they tell us? Now, the Dead Sea, so the title of the sermon is the Dead Sea Scrolls. We'll be talking about that in some detail here. What does the Dead Sea Scrolls really tell us is kind of the focus of what I want to do today. Now, again, a little history. The Roman Empire, the Maccabees, during 175 to 164 B.C., defeated the Seleucids in the first war in history for religious freedom, as I mentioned last time. The temple was restored, the high priest government was set up. Jewish fighting for the throne. Now, the Maccabees had restored things, but there was a lot of internal rivalries during that period of time. And different groups of Jews were trying to get control of things. And during some of this fighting, Roman general Pompey was recruited by a group of Jews to help them gain control. And so the Romans moved in and gradually took over the whole area. Herod the Great was a friend of the Romans, was educated by them, and he persuaded the Roman Senate to declare him king. And Jewish sects began to appear, various kinds of Jewish sects. The Zealots, who opposed Roman rule, and they revolted twice, the first being in this period around before and after 70 AD and the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. They were put down by the Romans then, but again they rose up in 132 to 135 AD and again were crushed by the Romans and disappeared. Nothing else was heard from them. The Sadducees were one of the main priestly groups during the time. The Pharisees were another sect of the Jews that had broader support from the people than the Sadducees. And then there were Essenes, and they were the separatists. And after Herod, Israel was divided into tetrarchies, as we've talked about before. And after the temple was destroyed, the Jews were forbid from Jerusalem. So this is the period of the Dead Sea Scrolls, from the time of the Maccabees until the destruction of the temple. That's the period of the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's the period of the community that had the Dead Sea Scrolls, wrote some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and obviously copied some of the others from the Old Testament. So that's what we're talking about here, that period of time. Now, the sect, the scholars believe that they were one of the Essene sects, and apparently there were many, but this was Qumran. Now, I have to be showing some slides of maps and that sort of thing here, but you can see this is the Dead Sea, an aerial view of the Dead Sea, and you can see there the location of Qumran, not too far from Jerusalem, right on the, basically, almost on the shores of the Dead Sea, pretty close there. And they were separatists. The reason they went there is because nobody was there. And they built their own little community there. Now, in late 46, early 1947, two Bedouin shepherds were there, and they were looking for a goat that strayed off. And one of them threw a rock into a cave, as the story goes, and heard a clay jar, pottery, break. So he went in to investigate, and he found some intact pottery jars and many pottery fragments. And so that was where the first of the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. Now, the community that grew up in that time, once this was discovered, archaeologists got real interested in the area. And so they began to excavate the area. And here's an aerial view of some of the excavations. They had a community there. And it was a series of clay, mud, bricks-type structures during that period of time. It appears that by the time of the collapse of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, during that same period of time, that's probably when that ended the Qumran sect. They were probably either left or were defeated during that period of time. But they had their own tight community. Now, here's a view where you can see some of the ruins of the that they excavated, and then over here in the background, these are where those caves were. You can see these hills. I wouldn't really call them mountains, but hills. That's where the caves were. Now, here's cave one, right down here. And there's cave two up there. And then here's another view of one of the caves. A little harder to reach this one. I'm not sure which one that is. But getting back to the story, in one of the jars that they found three scrolls wrapped in a linen cloth. They later went back and looked for some more. And they did find some more. Eventually, over a number of years, over about a 10-year period, they actually found 11 caves that had scrolls in it. But these first three were some of the most important of all the discoveries, as a matter of fact. Here's cave four. About half of all the scrolls and fragments that were found in cave four. You can see it's been cleaned up pretty good. The scrolls aren't there now. But if you want to see what they look like, here you can see a scroll in place, apparently where they found it in one of the caves. Here's another view. This is some kind of lantern that's lighting up the place, but you can see how things are just scattered all over the place in these caves. And most of the scrolls were in small pieces. A few, we'll talk more about that in some detail, but there were a few that were. But now what happened, these first scrolls that they found, they took to Bethlehem, and they sold them to a shoemaker who dabbled in antiquities. Okay, so and then So that's how they were actually discovered, through this shoemaker. Now, here's some more of the scrolls, and you can see how delicate they look. I mean, after all, they're about 2,000 years old, something on that order. Now, the shoemaker sold the first four scrolls to the Bishop of St. Mark's Syrian Orthodox Church in Jerusalem. Now, that's a Byzantine church. The four scrolls contain almost a complete copy of Isaiah. They contain what's been named the Habakkuk Commentary. It was a commentary on Habakkuk written by some of the Qumran scribes. It contained a paraphrase of some parts of Genesis. It contained a manual of discipline, which has been named the community rule. And this was basically the rules of that sect. And if you didn't follow these rules, you were punished. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. There was also something called a Thanksgiving scroll, and an incomplete copy of Isaiah. Now, these original four were later sold to Hebrew University. It's kind of an interesting story about that, because they were actually advertised in the New York Times. Anybody could have bought them, not realizing how valuable they were back at that time. But anyway, they all found themselves into possession of Hebrew University. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But they were there were other caves that were discovered. I said as the 11th was the last, and that was not found in 1956. So we're talking about almost a 10-year period of discovery of these various scrolls. Here's an example of one of the scrolls that was fairly intact. Not a lot of them were in this condition. Here's another one that's intact, but if you can kind of see, it looks like it's going to be a lot harder to read than the previous one I just showed you. Now, it was not until 1991 that all the scrolls and the fragments had been published. So it took a long time to get all of this out to the public. We'll talk about some of the reasons why in a minute. But let's look in more detail about the findings. There were a total of 60,000 fragments from an estimated 930 individual pieces. So they think there were about 930 original scrolls there. And what they found was a total of 60,000 fragments. Now, and a few reasonably complete scrolls. 223 were biblical manuscripts. Parts of all but Esther were found. The documents providing evidence of Jewish life during the Second Period. So there's a lot about Jewish life, about the life of the Qumran sect during that time. And so there were those types of documents. 249 sectarian texts. And about 191 non-sectarian texts, you know, just business kind of dealings and things like that that were found. There were a group of nearly 100 unidentified texts and 35 related primarily to the Qumran sect itself. So almost none were found completely intact. And only about a dozen were sufficiently intact for a continuous read. So there are only about a dozen that, like the scrolls that were opened, only about a dozen of that nature that were large enough to be read. Most of these 60,000 were the size of a credit card down to your thumbnail. You know, they were small fragments. Now, the Cave 1 scrolls were published in 1955. Caves 2, 3, 4, and 10 were published in 61 and 62. Cave 4, as I said, which contained about half the scrolls, was not begun to be published till 1982. And the last were not published until 1991. So, you know, roughly a 50-year period here or so that after the discovery, before all of the information was given to the public. And there were several reasons for this. One goes back to professors. These were all in the hands of professors. And you may not know professors, but I know professors. And I think I've mentioned before, I have not met a more arrogant bunch as a group in all my experience than professors. They think they know everything. So these scrolls were divvied up among professors. And they began to have this attitude, well, this belongs to me. And I'm going to study it, I'm going to study it, I'm going to research it, and I'm going to publish lots of papers and become famous. And so I'm not going to let anybody else see it until I have exhausted all the research. And so that was one of the reasons. There's several other reasons why they were so slow in publishing. Ownership was one of those. I'll talk about that more in a minute. But here's the problem. I mentioned the 60,000 fragments, 930 individual pieces. Because basically, you take out these few larger scrolls that were fairly intact, set them aside, and you've got all these fragments. Now, think of it as a jigsaw puzzle. Basically, you have a jigsaw puzzle that got to be put together from an unknown number of puzzles. You don't know how many for sure, how many different documents you had, with an unknown series of text, meaning if it was a jigsaw puzzle, an unknown picture for each one. You don't know what is going to be on it. And then with an unknown number of pieces missing. And that was another reason why it was so long in publishing some of this, because they had to try to piece it together. Now, as I was preparing this sermon, I saw a news article about the Dead Sea Scrolls. As a matter of fact, it may provide somewhat of a solution to putting some of these fragments together. The researchers did a modern DNA sequencing analysis to determine the genetic signature of 26 fragments. And the results, and this was published in the medical journal Cell in June of this year. So this was just, they took just a few fragments and did the DNA analysis to see what they could determine. And they found that they could be matched by genetic signatures. So you could piece them together that way. They analyzed a few fragments that they thought up to that point was from a single scroll of Jeremiah, but they found that one was calfskin and the other was sheepskin. And so there was a little mismatch there. So I wonder if in the next few years, as they do more of this genetic sequencing, they might be able to piece together more of these scrolls than they've been able to in the past. All right, a few questions that we can answer. What were the ages of the manuscripts? most of them were carbon 14 dated, and they ranged between around 200 to 100 AD. You know, there's usually a little room for error, but you can see that coincides very closely from the Maccabees to the destruction of Jerusalem. So it was during that period. Why the excitement about the discovery? Well, about the only other sources from this period outside, sources that go back to this far that have been discovered were not biblical sources, but Josephus and Philo, two historians in the first century AD, that period of time. There's some writings from them, but this was a dead period in history in terms of anything original from that time frame, and probably mainly because Israel or Judah was destroyed during that time. Jerusalem was destroyed during that time. So anything that might have been preserved wasn't. But maybe not. At the end of this sermon, I'll tell you what the most interesting scroll was, and although not particularly interesting from a religious point of view. But anyway, this will keep you from going to sleep because you want to hear the last scroll I'm going to talk about. All right, what were some of the more interesting findings? There were two copies of significant sections of Isaiah plus 17 fragments. So there was almost a complete Isaiah scroll, almost. There were 39 copies of portions of the Psalms, 20 copies of portions of Deuteronomy. There were writings not found in the Bible attributed to Moses, Joseph, additional prophecies attributed to Jeremiah, Daniel, Ezekiel, and additional psalms not found in the Bible. So some of these were apocrypha-type writings that they had at that time. And matter of fact, a number of them were. And some of them were their own writings that they had put together. And then the copper scroll. That's the one I'm going to talk about at the end. That's the most mysterious scroll that was found. Now, I mentioned the caves. Here's Qumran right here. Most of the caves were right in the general vicinity, but some of the caves were a little further away up in that area. So gives you an idea of the dispersal of the caves. And who were the scholars that studied the scrolls? Who were those professors? Well, part of the problem was that Qumran was a part of Jordan at the time. This was right around the time of Israel's independence, but they didn't occupy this part of Israel. As I said, three were purchased by a professor, Suknik, at Hebrew University. Four were purchased by the Bishop of St. Mark's. And from 48 to 56, additional caves and scrolls were found. Okay, so most of them were found by 1956. But Jordan occupied that area. That's part of Jordan at the time. So the scrolls were placed in the Palestine Archaeology Museum in East Jerusalem. And that's where they resided. Now, the Jordanian Department of Antiquities created a team of international scholars to investigate the scrolls. Now, these were all Old Testament era scrolls, but no Jews were on the team, and you don't have to explain why. So, but then in 1967, that was the Six-Day War, and Israel gained control of East Jerusalem, and they gained control of all the scrolls. Well, almost all of them. And so the Israel Antiquities Authority took control of the scrolls. Now, it so happened at that time there were a few scrolls that were on loan to a museum in Amman, Jordan. And those few scrolls, to this day, are still in the museum in Amman. But all the rest of the scrolls are controlled by, since 1967, are controlled by Israel. Now, there's two things that stand out from this, what the scholars have learned about these scrolls. The first is about not just the Qumran community itself, but of kind of what was going on in Judah during that period leading up to the time of Christ. You got a lot of information from that time. Now, by the way, practically everything I tell you is probably disputed by at least one scholar. People have all kinds of theories, but what I'm telling you is what the majority of the scholars have concluded. Now, there's some information about the Sadducees in some of these scrolls, supported by the nobility and the aristocracy. It was mainly a priestly group. Approach was mainly biblical. The Torah gave them the sole manner of worship. They denied the existence of angels and immortality of the soul. They denied the existence of oral law. Did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. And believed in free will only. And this was a big debate at that time, this business of free will. Predestination or free will? Which is it? Now, the Pharisees, which had broader support of the people, they developed customs and practices not found in the Bible, transferred many temple customs to the home, like the ceremonial washings used to be for the priest in the temple. They developed a procedure for ceremonial washings before meals in the home, things of that nature. Believed in angels and the immortal soul, and developed a concept of oral law equal to written law. And they took a middle ground on faith versus free will. They kind of believe some things are predestined, but you have free will in a lot of things, and they were kind of in the middle there. And then there were the zealots, and they were basically just wanted to fight. They wanted their independence, and their only belief was, we want a Judah free from Rome. And then the Essenes, the separatists, they lived communally. A strict approach to the law, stricter than the Jews themselves in Jerusalem, the mainline Jews, believed in predestination. They didn't believe in free will. And Qumran was a sect of the Essenes. The leader was called, I'm going to start talking about Qumran here. The leader was called the teacher of righteousness. And this is all this kind of stuff they're learning from those scrolls. they reinterpreted the Old Testament prophecies and had additional prophetic texts then in the Old Testament. They had the concept that some fulfilled Old Testament prophecies were a type of future prophecies. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And they probably used a different calendar from mainstream Judaism. So continuing on, they had apocalyptic beliefs. And one of the documents that was one of those 12 that was, a lot of it was intact, was called the War Scroll. Now this was one of their documents. It describes a coming war between the sons of light, which was Qumran, and the sons of darkness, the army of Belial, but it also included Rome and the other Jews that weren't a part of their sect. So there's this coming war that they describe in great detail. As the battle takes place on earth, a similar battle will be taking place in heaven between the good and bad angels. So this is all documented in the War Scroll as to how this is going to happen. And here's a view of the War Scroll that you can see there. If you look down in here, this looks like several separate pieces right in here that have been pieced together. You can see there's some separate pieces here. This gives you an idea of the kind of thing. Now, this is considered one of the more complete scrolls, okay, the War Scroll. So it gives you an idea that, boy, you're doing a lot just to get these things put together and make any sense out of it whatsoever. Okay, but let's go on. There's something called the Halakhic letter, and it designated the differences between Qumran beliefs and those of other Jewish groups. And they listed 20, what we would call very minor, legal differences. For example, I'll give you just one example so you can see what this is. They talk about pouring from a clean vessel, liquid into an unclean vessel, ceremonially clean. Here it's pure is the word that's used. But they say if you got a ceremonially clean vessel and you pour it into a ceremonially unclean vessel, that makes the original vessel unclean. Okay, so it's these kinds of things that they say, here's the difference between us and them. All right, so you learn a lot about both the Jews outside the community because they talk about them, and the Jews inside that community because they write about themselves and their beliefs. But then let's talk about the scrolls, the biblical scrolls, which is really what I want to get into here. The Psalms scroll, and by the way they designate these scrolls, and I'll show these designations from time to time. The first number there is the cave they were found in. This scroll was found in cave 11. Q stands for Qumran. And then Psalm means it's a psalm. And then that little superscript, A, means it's the first one they found of Psalms in cave 11. And so that's the kind of designation they use. All right. But this particular scroll was in pretty good shape, and it preserves a good amount of the book of Psalms. It included, at the end, five additional psalms. An end note states that David wrote 3,000 psalms and 364 songs, one for each day of the year. In other words, their calendar had 364 days. It had additional, they had additional festivals, such as the wine festival, the oil festival, the wood festival. So they had their own sect, and it was very tight-knit, it appears, far removed from everybody else. So let's look at some of the scrolls and see how they compare to the oldest scrolls we have of the Old Testament. Okay, we talked about that last time. The oldest scrolls we have of the Old Testament go back to around 1000 AD. The Aleppo Code, the Leningrad Code, some of these codes. And this collection of Old Testament, it was used for the modern translations of the Old Testament. So what they did in comparing these scrolls, they weren't, if I put up the Hebrew and said, look, this is saying that's different, it would be meaningless to you because you don't read, write, or even have any more idea than I do about Hebrew. So what I'm going to do, and this was an interesting approach, is to put up a key to what I'm going to show you. Now, I'm going to show you the English translation, but this key applies not to the English words, but to the Greek words that they were translated from, okay? Now, this happens to be a world English translation, but it's very similar to the New King James translation. Matter of fact, the New King James, World English are some of the few translations that use the same group of text coming from Byzantine. It's basically that area. We'll get into more into that when we talk about the New Testament. But you, if the letters are white, that means it's a literal translation of the Hebrew. The Hebrew is identical. Now, you can see here my code, if there's a minor spelling, now, they're comparing two scrolls or two groups of scrolls that are 1,000 years apart in age. So over 1,000 years, some spellings changed. And so if they're in this light green, it's minor spelling differences, but the words are the same words. If they've added or deleted actual Greek words, they're in red. Now, if they're completely missing, if the fragment does not has holes in it, or that section is a missing fragment, they filled it in black so that it would read. And then if some letters are unreadable, then you have this light blue. So that's kind of the code. And what I want to do, I haven't really gotten to any scriptures lately, have I? Yeah, this sermon's going to have some scriptures. We're going to look at Isaiah 53. 1Q, this means it was found from cave 1. This is one of those first ones found. Isaiah A, beginning in verse 1. Who has believed our message? To whom has the arm of Yahweh been revealed? For he grew up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. Okay, so you can see the Hebrew is exact, word for word. But there were some minor words that were spelled differently from the Byzantine text of 1,000 years later. All right, let's go a little further. He has no good looks or majesty. When we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men and a man of suffering and acquainted with disease. Now, here a word was added, and, that was not in the Hebrew. All right, let's finish out this verse here. He was despised as one from whom men hid their face, and we didn't respect him. Okay, now you can see a lot of it had spelling differences in this section. And, you know, about half and half between the exact same words and words with minor spelling differences. And one actual word was added in Hebrew in this section. Now, I mentioned that this is the World English Translation. Let me just show you. If you see the little asterisks above at the end of certain words, this is where it differs from the New King James Version. So, who has believed our report is the way the King James says it. Skipping on down there, for he grew up, King James says he shall grow. Skipping down further, he had no good looks or majesty. King James says form or comeliness. Going a little further, he was, he is. In the New King James, a man of suffering, a man of sorrows, in the King James. Now, a lot of these, the King James, New King James, will have a note referencing that this other translation may be more accurate in some of these. He was acquainted with disease, acquainted with grief, in the New King James. And from whom men hid their face, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. And then the last one, and we didn't respect him, we didn't esteem him. So you can see those translation differences are very minor. And we'll talk more about this in my next sermon when I get into the New Testament. But the New King James tends to be a more beautifully written, I guess, is the best way to describe it. All right, let's look at Psalm 51. This is from Scroll 4Q85, which was the fourth cave, and it was the 85th of the psalms that were discovered in that cave. Well, actually, it was the 85th fragment that was discovered, and it's third of the psalms, because that's what the little superscript C designates. And there's a note here at the beginning for the chief priest, or for the chief musicians, the Psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet came to him after he had gone into Bathsheba. And so then you have the first couple of verses here. I won't read through all of them. Ooh, I didn't realize that that was going to be canceled out so much. You can't see that very well. But right, these are all light blue. Okay, maybe that's pretty good because it's unreadable. So when you see that's unreadable, that's because it was unreadable. Okay, all right. Unintentionally did it happen that way, but you see you see how exact it was. And now remember, it's comparing Hebrew to Hebrew, but in the English translation. And so it's very accurate in this case, just a little bit that's unreadable. And that last sentence was not there. That's where the fragment ended. All right, so let's, and again, I'll put out the translations from World English to the New King James. Four, it was used, King James uses two. He'd gone into Bathsheba, went. Prophet came to him, and they say King James says went. Have mercy on, have mercy upon. For I know my transgressions, I acknowledge my transgressions. So you can see the translations are very, very similar. All right, here's some more from Psalm 51. And you see practically nothing is there. The black means that the fragments were missing. And so there's just a few words here and there. Now, whether this was just a very damaged fragment, again, you can see some light blue. Kind of shows up better at the top because the background is a little darker there. That's where it was simply unreadable. But you get the idea here. Wherever there's, you can actually read it. It seems to match up. The Hebrew matches up piece by piece. Now, this might have been a single fragment, but more than likely it was a bunch of fragments. Like probably this was this area was a fragment. This might have been a fragment. This was another. This might have been another fragment right in here, and so forth. And so, but that shows you some of the bad things that you just can't get much out of. Let's go to Genesis. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created. I won't read through all of this, but you can see quite a bit of black there, which means the fragments were missing. But what was there is very accurate, Hebrew for Hebrew, in terms of the translation. And you can see some more blue in there, which means that it was illegible. All right, let's go to verse 9 of Genesis 1. Now, here's a section where almost all of it is there. And almost all of it that is there is an exact Hebrew for Hebrew with just a few words that have different spellings. And very few fragments are missing. All right, let's look at Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 5, this is the introduction to the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy. And you can see here we have some red, which I speak in your ears today is what the Greek says. This day is what the Hebrew says. This day is what the Dead Sea Scrolls say. So it's a different Greek word there, or Hebrew word there. Again, some of it's unreadable, some of it's missing, and there are a few misspellings. But you can get the idea here that it's a Hebrew for Hebrew, 1,000 years apart, and it's very, very accurate. Let's go to verse 6. Here we're talking about the beginning of the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy. And you can see there's been a couple of ands deleted, and there's some misspelling or different spellings, but it's pretty much word for word in Hebrew to scrolls of 1,000 years later. Now let's drop on down again in Deuteronomy 5, but let's drop down to the Sabbath commandment. And here you can see there's been some changes. Now, these first changes are minor, taking out nor this or nor that. But they did add something at the end here. After talking about the Sabbath and so forth and coming out of Egypt, to sanctify it, because in 6 days Yahweh made the earth, heavens and earth, the sea and all things in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, Yahweh blessed the seventh day to sanctify it. So this was in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's not in the 1000 AD Hebrew codexes. And then here's the rest of the commandments. Again, a few minor things. The Hebrew word for desire was changed to one Hebrew word for covet. So not too much of a change there. So that gives you an idea of how accurate this translation was compared to one that was preserved 1,000 years later. Now, why are we comparing it to one that was 1,000 years later? Because that's the oldest we have. We don't have anything in between. But very few changes. So that gives us a lot of confidence that our Old Testament is indeed very accurate. Now, let's conclude with the copper scroll. Now, the copper scroll was totally different from any other scroll found. It was found in a cave with no other scrolls, just the copper scroll. It was made of copper, as the name suggests. For years, they couldn't unscroll it. It was too fragile. And so they eventually figured out a way to slice it without damaging it so they could open it up, and you see the sections, the curved sections, that they were able finally to open it up. Here's a close-up view. It wasn't printed on the scroll. It was impressed into the scroll. You can see these Hebrew letters there. They were imprinted. And so, completely different than anything else. It was only one found. It does not fit into any classification system. It was written in the form of Hebrew, different from the rest of the scrolls. Scribes have a style. This was written in a completely different style. The script is different. Certain words have different spellings. And it appears to be a treasure map. Now, what this does, it gives 64 locations detailing treasure contained at each. In addition, in some of these locations, there's temple vessels, priest garments, and other temple furnishings. 64 different places. The total in terms of gold and silver, if you add up all what they record in these scrolls, about 25 tons of gold and 65 tons of silver. Wow. Wouldn't you like to stumble across that treasure? And the locations are very specific. I mean, very specific. It's by, you go to a pool of XYZ in the city of this, KXY, and you look at the third column and dig down there, you know, those kinds of detailed instructions. There's only one little problem. Nobody knows where I've ever heard of that city, and nobody ever heard of that pool, and there's no evidence of any columns that might fit the description of that. So all these very exacting types of directions on how to find it, but nobody has had any luck. And the 64th has no treasure, but another scroll with more information. Okay. So, if you want to become one of the wealthiest people on earth and one of the most famous people on earth, hop on over to Israel and find those locations. Okay. Well, nobody has had any success with it yet. Now, there are a number of theories here. One of the theories that is a pure fantasy, since the Qumran community would not have had such wealth. Now, we don't know that it's from the Qumran community. We don't know that it's from that 200 BC period. Why? The scroll is made of copper. You need organic material to date it. It's not organic. They can't use carbon-14 dating. They don't know exactly how old it is, just that it seems to be very old. Okay? So it may not even have been Qumran. All right, another theory. The location of the temple treasures that were hidden in the siege and fall of Jerusalem in 66 to 70 AD. Maybe the Jews in Jerusalem, the priest, went out, found a cave, and hid everything in there. or at least hid the instructions of where to find in 64 different locations where they spread out all the loot. That's one theory. Another theory is that it was hidden by the Knights Templar during the Crusades. But as I said, the treasure hunters have tried with no success in finding the treasure. So next time you keep the feast in Israel, see if you can find some of it. All right. So let's summarize here as we come to the end of the sermon. What does it tell us, the Dead Sea Scrolls? As the oldest Old Testament biblical scrolls by almost 10 centuries, they were remarkably similar to Hebrew texts such as the Aleppo Codex that we had talked about last time. The accuracy of the Old Testament is verified. Now, keep in mind one thing here. There were some extra stuff there. They had their own writings. Remember what we talked about last time? The Levites in Jerusalem were responsible for the canonization of the Old Testament. These people weren't. And so they had different stuff. But the stuff they had from the Old Testament was pretty good. There were religious literature circulating during the period leading up to the time of Christ that had been unknown until the discovery of the scrolls. So some of this stuff was completely unknown until the Dead Sea Scrolls, things like the War Scroll and things like that. And the Qumran sect saw the Jerusalem high priesthood as corrupt. They saw what Christ saw. And they weren't the only ones, I'm sure. The Essenes, as a group, were a bunch of separatist groups, really. And they were separatists because they saw that corruption. The Jewish sects of the time were strongly in disagreement with one another on certain doctrinal things, like the immortal soul, like predestination. It appears that Qumran had their own ideas of what texts were canonical. In other words, they put together their own Bible. And apparently Qumran had some biblical texts that they edited to meet their own beliefs that differed from traditional Judaism at the time. Now, that other Isaiah scroll, there were two Isaiah scrolls that had a lot in it. The other one was heavily edited. There were changes and edited and comments and so forth. It was heavily edited, so it was a little bit different from the one that we were looking at here. It appears that they had done some editing to make it fit more with their doctrines. You know, so overall, that Isaiah scroll is 95% word for word, the one we were looking at. So, again, we're talking about circumstantial evidence. We could say that the Jews did an excellent job of preserving the Old Testament from the Christ time up until 1,000 years later. You could say they did an excellent job. I think what we should say is that God did an excellent job of preserving the Old Testament.